Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Several large wildfires are burning in California, where extreme heat and dry, windy conditions are fueling the flames. Two of the three largest fires in state history are burning in the northern San Francisco Bay Area. Reports say more than 14,000 firefighters are battling those fires and over 20 others across California. The fire danger also is high in Southern California, where fires were burning in Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and San Diego counties. The U.S. Forest Service closed all 8 national forests in the area on Monday and shut down campgrounds around the state. September and October are traditionally wildfire season in California. A record 809,000 hectares have burned this year. The previous record, set 2 years ago, included the deadliest wildfire in state history. That fire destroyed most of the community of Paradise and killed 85 people. Officials have blamed the record-breaking fires on electricity lines, along with strong winds and dry conditions. To guard against new wildfires, California's biggest electricity provider now cuts power to areas with high-risk conditions. In recent days, power was cut to more than 172,000 homes in an effort to prevent new fires. The wildfire situation throughout California is dangerous and must be taken seriously, said Randy Moore, an official with the U.S. Forest Service's Pacific Southwest region. Existing fires are displaying extreme fire behavior. New fire starts are likely. Weather conditions are worsening, and we simply do not have enough resources to fully fight and contain every fire, he added. On Saturday, National Guard rescuers in 2 military helicopters airlifted 214 people to safety after flames trapped them in a wooded camping area near Mammoth Pool Reservoir. The man-made lake is north of the city of Fresno. 12 people were hospitalized, 2 of them with serious injuries. Early Tuesday, California National Guard and Navy helicopters rescued another 13 people trapped in Fresno County. The rescue flights had been delayed because of heavy smoke Monday night. Lynn Tolmachoff is a spokeswoman for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. She told the Associated Press it was unnerving to have already reached a record for area burned when September and October are usually the worst months for fires. 900 wildfires have been reported in California since August 15th. Many of them are believed to have been caused by lightning strikes in the middle of August. there have been 8 fire deaths and more than 303,000 structures destroyed. California faced a serious heat wave during the Labor Day holiday weekend. Much of California reached temperatures above 38 degrees Celsius. Death Valley, a desert area in eastern California, hit a record high of 51.7 Celsius on Saturday. That number beat the former record of 48 Celsius set in 2017, the National Weather Service said. Some parts of the U.S. also experienced huge temperature changes in recent days. One of those areas is the western city of Denver, Colorado. On Monday, Denver reached a temperature of at least 33 degrees Celsius. For Tuesday, state weather officials predicted the low to be well below 0 degrees Celsius, the Denver Post reported. The officials also predicted stormy conditions, including snow. The big temperature drop could break a state record. The largest one-day temperature change in history for Denver was set back in January 1872. I'm Brian Lynn.
Trude Lamb is a top cross-country runner at Robert E. Lee High School in Tyler, Texas. But the name on her sports jersey, she says, is a sharp reminder of a man who didn't believe people like me were 100% human. Over the summer, she wrote a letter to Tyler school board officials. Lamb, who is from Ghana, told them she had seen the horrific conditions of slave dungeons on the African coast. She said that she could not support a name that celebrates a Confederate general who fought on the side of slavery. Lee commanded Southern rebel forces against the U.S. military during the Civil War. Along with many current and former students at the high school, Lamb pushed to change the school's name this year. The campaign was launched under the hashtag #WeWon'tWearTheName. The school board approved the change in July after years of resistance. That name was not a black supporter. He owned slaves, said Lamb. He did anything he could to harm or remove black people, she added. I'm like, no, not wearing this name on my jersey, she told the Associated Press. More than 100 public schools in the United States are named for Confederate leaders. Perhaps 90% of them are named for General Robert E. Lee, Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or General Stonewall Jackson. That information comes from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Many of the schools were founded as all-white schools during the days of racial segregation. But now they also serve African-American students. At least 12 now have majority black student bodies. A new push has come to rename many of the schools as nationwide protests over police abuse and racial injustice have led to the removal of Confederate statues. Several school systems in Alabama, Texas, and Virginia have voted to change school names in recent months, but local resistance and state laws make that no simple act. Lamb gained national attention for for her letter to the Tyler, Texas School Board. She has since become a target of social media attacks with racist language and even threats of violence, her mother said. In Montgomery, Alabama, three high schools are named after Lee, Davis, and Sidney Lanier, a writer who was a Confederate soldier. It's a basic insult to all the African American children who would have to walk past a statue or go to a school that is named after a white supremacist, said America Blair. She was among those pushing for the change. Blair attended Robert E. Lee High in Montgomery and completed her studies there in 2009. The Montgomery County School Board voted in July to change the names of the three schools. But a 2017 state law protects Confederate statues and other long-standing memorials and names. The school system will have to get special permission from a committee, and the soonest it would get a decision is October. If denied, the school system must pay $25,000 for breaking the law by changing the name without permission. Like many other Confederate-named schools, Lee in Montgomery opened as an all-white school in 1955. That was 1 year after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregated schools were unconstitutional. At that time, the South was actively fighting federal orders to integrate. But after integration became law, white people left some neighborhoods. So a lot of the schools became heavily African American. A statue of Lee stood outside the school for many years, facing north to keep an eye on his enemies, school legend says. But in June, a group of people pushed the statue down. Four individuals were arrested, but the charges were later dropped. Similar pushes to rename schools are taking place across the country. The Southern Poverty Law Center said about 40 schools have been renamed or closed in the past few years. In Virginia, the removal of Confederate names began in the state's northern cities and towns in 2018. That is when J.E.B. Stuart High in Falls Church changed to Justice High. The movement to change school names expanded outside Northern Virginia as Black Lives Matter protests took hold after the police killing of George Floyd in May. For example, in Hanover County, a conservative area near Richmond, the school board voted narrowly to change the name of Lee Davis High. Changing names is part of the move from one period in history to another, noted historian Wayne Flint. He has written many history books on the American South. Flint pointed out a connection between school names and inequity. He said the same beliefs that led to the Confederate school names also created education systems that often leave minority children in underfunded and failing schools. I'm Alice Bryant.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. As president, John Adams was head of the Federalist Party, but the power of that position really belonged to former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. For this and other reasons, Adams did not like Hamilton. He said he would rather be a minister to Europe under Jefferson than a president controlled by Hamilton. Hamilton did not like Adams either. Hamilton did everything he could to block Adams from becoming president again. He gave his support to another Federalist candidate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Under the electoral system at that time, the candidate with the most votes became president. The candidate with the second highest number of votes became vice president. A Federalist victory in the election of 1800 would not be easy. The Republicans had a very strong and popular candidate in Thomas Jefferson. So Federalist Party leaders attempted to change the electoral system. The Constitution said state legislatures were to choose electors to vote for president. The Federalists tried to gain control over the legislature's decisions. They wanted Congress to create a special committee to rule if an elector had or did not have the right to vote. The committee could say if an elector's vote should be counted or thrown away. The committee would have 6 members from the Senate and 6 members from the House of Representatives. The 13th member would be the Chief Justice of the United States. Creating such a committee violated the Constitution. Federalist leaders knew this, so they wanted Congress to approve the committee but keep the measure secret until after the election. The Federalists held a majority of seats in the Senate, and the Senate voted to approve the proposal. But some Federalist members of the House of Representatives denounced it. They made many changes in the proposal. The Senate refused to accept the changes. Without agreement by both houses of Congress, the bill died. Federalist leaders saw their hopes for an election victory begin to disappear. By the summer of 1800, Thomas Jefferson's Republican Party had strong leaders in every state. It had many newspapers to express party ideas. Jefferson decided to take a holiday at Monticello, his farm in Virginia. The Republican Party leader in New York was a lawyer, Aaron Burr. Burr had served as an officer under General George Washington during America's War for Independence from Britain. After the war, he joined the Federalist Party and was elected to the United States Senate. Later, he changed parties and became a Republican. In 1800, a group of both Federalists and Republicans supported him as a candidate for president. Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton were bitter enemies. When Hamilton learned of his own party's support for electing Burr, his reaction was quick and sharp. "Anybody," he said, "even Thomas Jefferson, is better than Aaron Burr. Jefferson is not dangerous. Burr is. Jefferson's ideas of government are wrong, but at least he is an honest man. Burr is a man without honesty and character. He will destroy America," Hamilton said. The president elected in 1800 would govern from a new capital city. The national government would move from Philadelphia to Washington, a newly built city in the District of Columbia. It was along the Potomac River between the states of Maryland and Virginia. When President Adams and his wife Abigail arrived in Washington, they found a frontier town. There were few houses or streets. Mrs. Adams could not believe what she saw. She wrote to her daughter, "This is a city only because we call it a city. Our house here is very big, but the rooms are not finished. There is almost no furniture. There are not enough lamps for light." John Adams also wrote to his wife about the house where the president would live. In a letter, he asked heaven to bless the house and whoever lived in it. A later president asked for Adams' blessing to be carved above a fireplace.
There is a mantle there with an inscription from John Adams saying, "May all future residents of this house be virtuous creatures."
Joseph Ellis is a historian and the author of many books about America's founding fathers. He says John Adams' words can still be found in the White House today. A street called Pennsylvania Avenue went from the president's house to the Capitol building where Congress would meet. On each side of the street, where buildings stand today, there were fields of mud. This was the new federal city, the new capital of the United States. This was where the winner of the presidential election of 1800 would begin his term of office. John Ferling taught American history at the University of West Georgia. He says Jefferson's party campaigned better and listened to the concerns of ordinary people.
The Republicans, the Jeffersonians, understood the American political process, the more democratic process that was coming into being, better than the Federalists did, and it enabled them to win a couple of key states, and that spelled doom for Adams.
George Washington won America's first two presidential elections without opposition. John Adams won the third presidential election by 3 electoral votes. This time, in 1800, there was no clear winner. When the electors' votes were counted, President Adams had 65 votes. But Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each had 73 votes. So under the Constitution, the House of Representatives would have to choose between Jefferson and Burr, the candidates with the highest number of votes.
Each congressman could vote, but each state had just one vote. That vote would go to the candidate supported by a majority of congressmen from the state. A candidate had to receive a majority of the state votes to win. In 1800, that meant 9 of the 16 states. The Federalists saw the situation as their last chance to control the presidency. They had two plans. They would try to block the Congress from electing either Jefferson or Burr as president. Then they would try to find a way to put executive power in the hands of a Federalist. If that plan failed, they were prepared to elect Burr. The Federalists tried to make people believe that Burr was working with them against Jefferson. Burr denied this. In a letter to Jefferson, Burr wrote, "Every Republican wants you to be president of the United States. Every good Republican wants to serve under you. I would be happy and honored to be your vice president. And if you believe I could help you better in some other position, I would do so." On February 11th, the House of Representatives began to count votes state by state. 8 states chose Jefferson. 6 chose Burr. The representatives of 2 states, Maryland and Vermont, gave each man an equal number of votes. There was no majority within those states, so neither man won the votes of those states. The voting continued. All that day and throughout the night, the representatives voted. 27 times, the count remained the same. 8 states for Jefferson, 6 for Burr, 2 undecided. The next morning, the representatives decided to rest for 4 hours. The voting began again at noon. There was no change. The 13th of February passed, then the 14th and 15th. Still no change. The House voted 33 times. It could not elect a president. A change in the vote of just one congressman from Maryland or Vermont could decide the contest. Later, after the election, the representative from Delaware said he had met with 2 congressmen from Maryland and 1 from Vermont. All were Federalists. All had voted for Aaron Burr. The Delaware congressman said they claimed they spoke with a friend of Thomas Jefferson. He said they told Jefferson's friend they would change their votes if Jefferson made certain promises. Jefferson denied that he had made any political promises. He said many men tried to get promises from him, but he said he told all of them that he would never become president with his hands tied. The House of Representatives voted for the 36th time on February 17th. 10 states, including Maryland and Vermont, voted for Thomas Jefferson. 4 states voted for Aaron Burr. 2 states, Delaware and South Carolina, did not vote, but Jefferson had the majority he needed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.